We weren't always as smart as we think we are today. Way back when, a million years or so ago, we were not even smart enough to come in out of the cold. And so today, we pause to ask, what did we eat that made us so smart?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1219th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show, or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Wanaka, who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, when it comes to having a discussion about what is best to eat, we often remind me of a bunch of hyenas fighting over a carcass of an antelope. Some insist we must avoid eating industrial foods and only eat foods that have been certified organic under the direct supervision of the federal government. Then others will say we should avoid eating saturated fats and eat only foods packaged with labels that say low fat. And then there are those who insist we should stop eating the flesh of animals and eat only plants and the derivatives of plants, like that Impossible Burger. However, for this discussion, we are going to set aside our dietary squabbles about what we should eat and go back, way back, to solve a mystery about what we did eat way back when that enabled us to grow the big, beautiful brains we now have that make us so smart. And who better to lead us back in time than Dr. Brianna Pobiner, research paleoanthropologist, Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. Dr. Pobiner, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks for having me.
Paleoanthropologist. Does that mean you're an anthropologist that only eats meat?
No, but that's a good guess. It means I'm an anthropologist that studies the past, basically, particularly human evolution.
Mm-hmm. And what is exactly your research specialty? You have carved out a little tiny niche that's very important and significant to our understanding of how we evolved as a human being.
Well, one of the most important adaptations that any organism has is its diet. And so I'm particularly interested in the evolution of human diets, how that's changed over time. And in particular, I'm interested in the origin and evolution of meat eating in human prehistory, how that might have shaped changes in our behavior, changes in our ecology, changes in our bodies, because it was, as anything is, in nature, you know, kind of you are what you eat.
There you are.
And it has a lot of implications for evolution.
Well, how on earth did a suburban girl in New York come to be a bone detective in Africa?
Yeah, that's a good question.
What was that magic apple that fell on your head one day?
Well, I guess the magic apple was probably in the form of a college professor. So I went to Bryn Mawr College, which is an all-women's liberal arts undergraduate, mostly undergraduate institution outside of Philadelphia. But when I started college, I thought I wanted to probably be an English major or maybe comparative literature. I knew that I really liked writing and poetry. My first semester, I had a dean that suggested that I take an anthropology class. I was looking for a fourth class. I had never heard of anthropology before. She used to be an anthropology professor, and I trusted her. And I absolutely, really from the first day, fell in love with this field of scientific inquiry that is all about people. It's all about how we became who we are, and it really is all about solving mysteries. And so I had a class in my second semester with a professor who was teaching at Bryn Mawr named Janet Monge, and she's one of the best teachers I ever had, and I really just never looked back.
There you are. It's interesting because I was an English lit, Chinese lit major, but I always liked anthropology too. And just always seemed interesting. I guess it is because it's all about people. And now you're a researcher with a Smithsonian Institution, and you just got back from Africa, right?
I did. I was in Kenya last month doing some research there.
Okay, good. Well, one of the questions I really wanted to focus on a little bit is, why Africa? Why do all of the anthropologists run back to Africa and not like North Dakota?
Well, you know, it's funny. I've actually done some. My first ever internship was collecting invertebrates in, not North Dakota, but South Dakota, actually, with the American Museum of Natural History. So that got me hooked on fossils. But your question about Africa, so our evolutionary tree extends back about 6 or 7 million years. That's the time in which we share a common ancestor with today's living chimpanzees. They're our closest living relatives. So in the 6 or 7 million years of human evolution, it wasn't until 2 million years ago that we have any fossil record of early humans migrating out of Africa. So the first 4 or 5 million years of human evolutionary history all occurred in Africa. And then even after that time, a lot of really important prehistoric sites or paleoanthropological sites are in Africa. So the reason that there's so much research going on there is because there's a lot left to study, either things that have already been excavated or just to go out and find more fossils.
Yeah, it's like it's where the money is, and that's where you rob the banks, right? You just go there because that's where all the fun is.
Exactly.
So for the best part of last century, the early part of last century at least, most thought that all of the action was in Europe or in Asia. But what happened to change our mind about that that led us back to Africa?
That's exactly right. So it wasn't until 1924 when a fossil skull of a small child of a young early human, a species called Australopithecus africanus, was found in South Africa. That really put Africa on the map. That was the Tong child found from the site of Tong in South Africa. That put Africa on the map as far as thinking about human origins. And then when Lewis and Mary Leakey were doing excavations in Kenya and Tanzania, and they started to find more early human fossils at various sites, that started to also put East Africa on the map. And once the techniques for determining how old fossils were, usually based on dating the layers that the fossils were found in, once those got more and more refined and scientists started to understand that all of the earlier stages of human evolution and all those earlier fossils were found in Africa, now Africa is really the place to be to investigate that earliest part of human evolution.
And how early? We understand the earliest was found in Ethiopia. Was that correct?
Actually, the two earliest species on the human family tree, one is called Auroran tuginensis, and that's from the Tugen Hills of Kenya, and the other is Sahelanthropus chadensis from Chad. So both of them are dated to somewhere around 6, maybe 7 million years ago. We do have lots of fossils from Ethiopia, but the earliest ones so far on our family tree are either from Kenya or from Chad.
Okay. Now, when you go to Africa, as you do, where do you go? Where do you go to dig?
So a couple different places. I've been involved in excavations that the Smithsonian has run under the auspices of Dr. Rick Potts, who's the head of the Human Origins Program. I've been excavating at a site called Alorga Saili in southern Kenya. I started excavating there in 2005, and I'm still studying some of the fossils from that site. I also have a field site in central Kenya in a wildlife conservancy at a place called Olpejeta Conservancy. There I'm looking at the modern bones of dead animals scattered across the landscape to get a sense of how habitat and predation pressure might affect that sort of bone community and whether it accurately reflects the living animal community. So it's interesting. Most people think, well, archaeologists just always go and dig in the dirt. I actually spend quite a lot of time doing experiments or making observations in the modern world. And then I also spend time when I'm in Kenya at the National Museums of Kenya in Nairobi in their paleontology department looking at fossils that have already been excavated. I'm particularly looking for traces of butchery by early humans on animal fossils, and sometimes discoveries are best made in the collections or in the lab.
Wow. Now, when we see photographs and whatnot of places where people are doing digs, they always seem to be in very desolate places. Given what you know about the history of those places, were they always desolate?
No, and actually there's been a lot of changes in habitats and climates and environments over time. So when we're excavating at Ilorgas Islay, it's pretty much a semi-desert now with a lot of erosion and very bleak-looking areas. But there were times in the past where there was an ancient lake or a rushing river. So a lot of times the places where people are excavating now that are desert-like, those are great places to excavate because oftentimes there's a lot of erosion happening when it rains. But more often than not in the past, during some times, they were much wetter and maybe warmer than they are today.
Pretty good indication that climates have been changing for quite a while then, right?
Absolutely. So, there's really not any kind of pristine, steady state of ancient climates that humans evolved in. Really, humans actually evolved during one of the most dramatic times of climate change in Earth's history.
Now, how do you know where to dig? When you look at the landscape, you see this beautiful, bleak landscape. You think, I'm going to go over there and dig because that's probably where I'll find something. How do you know where to dig?
There's a couple different ways to figure out where you might want to put an excavation and hopefully not just dig a giant hole with nothing in it. One is that often people go to places where fossils or artifacts have been found previously. They can look in scientific publications. They can look in museum records. Another thing is that we tend to do survey before we do excavation. So that's basically walking around the landscape looking to see if there are any fossils or artifacts eroded out, and particularly looking for the layer of sediment, like in a side of a hill, where we think those fossils are actually in situ or they're eroding out from. So that's the place where we target to excavate.
Not unlike looking for gold.
No, it's true. And another thing that we do is we use different kinds of maps. So oftentimes we use geological maps that tell us how old the different sediments are in different places. So if I'm interested in, early meat eating dating back 1 million or 2 million years ago, I want to go to the place where the sediments are that age.
Good. And what is it about your equipment that you take into the field? What do you bring with you?
So we bring a lot of equipment into the field, besides the basic things like, equipment to cook with and tents to sleep in. The excavation equipment we use are usually trowels, which are kind of triangular-shaped looking shovels. We take buckets that we put the sediment in that we are excavating. We take sieves because all of that sediment goes through a fine screen to make sure that we catch any small bones that we didn't actually see during excavation. Paintbrushes, dental picks even, to do very delicate excavation. Sometimes we sieve with water. Sometimes we just sieve when the sediment is dry. So kind of just basic digging equipment.
And there you go. Well, when we're going to have to take a quick break, this is the 1219th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. Today, we're going in search of that we ate so many years ago, about 1 million years ago, that changed the nature of our physical being and led us to develop a much bigger brain that made us as smart as we are today. And we do think we're pretty darn smart today. We have with us today Dr. Brianna Pobiner, who is a research paleoanthropologist, easy for me to say, at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. And the focus of our subject today is, what is it that we ate way back when that made us so smart today? This is the Food Chain Radio Program, Michael Olson. We will be right back. Please do stay tuned.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, we are in Africa today with Dr. Brianna Pobiner, research paleoanthropologist, Smithsonian Institution. We're digging in the dirt, and by golly, we find some bones. What are we looking for on those bones, Doctor?
So what I'm looking for in particular are little linear marks that let me know that an early human butchered that animal 1 million, 1.5 million, or 2 million years ago.
Now, I saw a video of you holding a little bone fragment, and in total amazement, you were looking at it. What did you see on that little bone fragment?
So I would have seen those butchery marks left by early humans. And those are really, it's very hard to get direct traces of behavior dating back millions of years ago. But those butchery marks are exactly that. They let us know what kinds of animals people were eating, what parts of those animals they were eating, maybe whether they were hunting those animals or scavenging them, depending on where those marks are located.
Wow. And how do you know? How do those little marks tell you, give you so much information?
Well, once you can identify them as butchery marks and not marks made by something else, hopefully you'll be able to figure out what kind of bone those butchery marks are on. Are they on a leg bone? Are they on part of the backbone? Are they on ribs? That can give an indication of whether the early humans got access to that carcass early on in that carcass's life, in the sense of after an animal dies, all the juicy parts are usually eaten first by predators. But there, if the butchery marks are on the bones that are the juiciest, that means the early humans got there first.
Well, good. As a academic, as a detective of bones, you're out there to solve a mystery. What mystery exactly did you select to investigate as part of your research, Doctor?
So one of the big mysteries I'm trying to solve is, when early humans first started eating meat from big animals that they couldn't just take down themselves, that they didn't have the tools to be able to hunt and butcher, or at least hunt, I want to know whether early humans may have been scavenging from the leftovers of predator kills. You know, that... Go ahead.
And tell us a little bit about the difference then between chimpanzees and humans. And something happened like, 57 million years ago or something like that to really change, to differentiate us?
Yeah, it's a good question. And so we, chimpanzees and bonobos, they're our closest living relatives, and we share a common ancestor that dates to somewhere between 6 and 7 million years ago. So modern humans have been evolving on their own lineage for that amount of time, as has chimpanzees. But there are many differences between chimps and modern humans, including things about our diet, our behavior, our cognition, our social structure. And so those differences really accumulated over the 6 or 7 million years of our evolutionary history.
And at some point along the line, we became Homo erectus.
Correct. So that Homo erectus is a species that evolved just after about 2 million years ago, at about 1.9 million years ago. And this is an interesting species because it was the first one on our family tree to migrate out of Africa, the first one to probably incorporate a significant amount of meat into its diet, and the first one to have a more modern human-like body size and shape.
And how do you know? How do you distinguish? You have to have something to compare it to, right?
You do. And so the more fossils that we have that we can compare new fossil finds to, the more accurate our ability is to be able to basically figure out where the variation in one species ends and another species begins.
How many species of human-like critters were there running around back then?
It depends on the time and place. And so, like, our entire evolutionary tree from that split with the, after the common ancestor with chimpanzees, depending on who you ask, because there are some debates over whether some fossils represent different species or not, somewhere like 20 species. Now, a lot of them did overlap in time with other species. In fact, it's kind of an unusual time in our evolutionary history that we're the only human species on the planet.
Wow. There's a mystery, right? What happened to everybody else? There
exactly.
You go.
Exactly.
There you go. Well, this Homo erectus critter, human-like person, made a big decision to somehow eat good food. And, of course, they had to compete with other critters for that good food. And the good food we're talking about back then would have been meat and fat and something else, right?
Well, there could have been. I mean, certainly they were eating plants. They were probably eating insects. They were probably eating other, like fruit and leaves and things. So, but yeah, it's interesting. It seems like incorporating larger amounts of meat into the diet was something that really only started with Homo erectus.
And what was it about Homo erectus, though, that enabled them to do the meat eating that other critters were not? other
That's a mystery that I would say we still haven't quite solved yet. So maybe it was the fact that their body size was bigger than those earlier species. Maybe they were able to intimidate carnivores, drive them off of kills. Maybe it was something about their social interaction. Maybe they were living in bigger groups. But we actually don't know the answer to that question.
Mm-hmm. Now, some time ago, I did a radio show with a person, a paleoanthropologist, who suggested that adopting dogs or wolves had a lot to do with their ability to hunt more efficiently. Have you ever given that a thought?
Yeah, it's an interesting idea, and I suspect that might have been maybe Pat Shipman who you chatted with.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. And so, the idea that modern humans may have been able to outcompete other species, including Neanderthals, because they, began to domesticate dogs and there was this kind of mutually beneficial relationship, I think that very well could be for later time periods, but probably not likely for the time period in which Homo erectus was around.
Which was a long time ago now, a couple million years, right?
Correct. So they evolved about 1.9 million years ago, although they persisted all the way up to maybe about 110,000 years ago. They're actually the longest lived species on the human family tree.
Wow. Okay, so one of the things we recognized in comparing the skulls of Homo erectus with others is that the teeth got smaller, brains got bigger.
That's exactly right. Body size got more human-like. They got taller. They went from being kind of having a more like cone-shaped thorax or abdomen area to having a more barrel-shaped abdomen or thorax. And so, yeah, there were a lot of changes that happened. And it's interesting. There have been ideas that some of these physical changes were due to this change in diet to eating more meat.
Okay.
So that's an idea that's out there.
Now, what is the speculation about how Homo erectus went out on the plains and started competing for the big animals with, saber-toothed tigers and whatnot?
Yeah, so saber-toothed tigers, there were three different kinds of saber-toothed cats that were around with Homo erectus. So it's most likely, at least based on the evidence for technology that we have, because we don't have evidence for hunting technology until half a million years ago, that actually what Homo erectus was probably doing is scavenging, and maybe doing something called passive scavenging, where they waited until predators were completely finished with their kills, the coast was clear, everything was safe, and they went in and got the leftovers. That's the other idea is called confrontational or active scavenging or power scavenging, and that really involves chasing carnivores off of kills. That would have been a lot more dangerous. There is an idea that you would have gotten a lot more meat having to do that, but some work that I've done and other folks have shown that actually even passive scavenging can yield you a lot of meat.
And it was not only meat, but it was something with respect to the bones that was really important as well, correct?
Exactly. So inside the leg bones of most animals is marrow. And marrow has a lot of fat. It has a lot of calories. It would have been a fantastic resource, especially because if early humans like Homo erectus were scavenging from kills made by saber-toothed cats or the ancestors of lions and leopards and cheetahs, thinking about other African felids or big cats, most of them don't have the jaw strength to actually break open these big bones. All Homo erectus would have needed was a nice round rock, break open a leg bone, and get all that beautiful marrow.
And so we enter the world of tool making.
Exactly. Interestingly, right now, the earliest evidence for early human butchery on animal fossils, it dates to about 3.3 million years ago, 3.4 million years ago. The butchery marks on those fossils have been hotly contested, but the earliest evidence we have for stone tool making goes back to 3.3 million years ago. So it is very likely, or at least possible, that the earliest stone tools, the earliest technology was made in order to butcher animals.
Now, having been raised up in the high prairie of Montana, fully aware of the Indian culture and the buffalo jumps that they used to fashion, and they just to kill the buffalo, they just run them off a cliff and then go down and butcher them. And so we were accustomed to finding arrowheads, which were stones that have been shaped and chipped into sharp instruments. But what we're talking about here is something entirely different. It's something, instead of a something that stabs something, it's something that bludgeons them, right?
Exactly. So the earliest stones would have either been unmodified rocks, just cobbles that fit nicely in your hand if all you're going to do is break open bones to get at marrow, or very simple, any rock with a sharp edge. You can take one rock, your hammer stone, and knock off a flake from another rock called your core. It didn't need to be a very sophisticated tool. All it needed to be was a sharp edge in order to cut into the skin and be able to slice meat off the bone.
So this is really going to the heart of your research then, isn't it? Just how did Homo erectus start eating meat and fats and subsequent development of the brain? What difference did it make in the brain? Have you been able to measure that?
Well, it's interesting. So there's a hypothesis called the expensive tissue hypothesis, originally, that linked eating meat and possibly marrow with the expansion of the human brain. So humans have ginormous brains. Our brains are about 20%, they take about 20% of our energy, but they're only actually about 2% of our body size. So they're very energetically expensive. And so this hypothesis suggested that the only way to grow such energetically expensive tissue is to basically shrink it somewhere else, and that somewhere else was our guts. And the way to basically selection pressure for smaller guts may have been the ability, part of that may have been the ability to eat meat. The only problem with that story is that actually the evidence for meat eating goes back much further in time than the evidence for a big increase in brain size in our evolutionary history. So early human brain size kind of tracked body size through time until about a million years ago. At that point, we see a really big increase in brain size relative to body size. And what happened, at least right now, that we have evidence for a million years ago, the earliest cooking.
Ah, barbecue.
Exactly. So it may not have been meat specifically or marrow or animal tissue initially that led to that big increase in brain size, but it's possible that cooking, which made food, you know, it made poisonous food edible, it chemically and physically breaks down food and makes it easier to digest. We may have just been able to eat more and better food once we started cooking it.
And that was a million years ago.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And how long did Homo erectus last again?
The most recent extinction dates are somewhere around about 110,000 years ago. So they lasted for an awfully long time.
Gosh, that's almost like yesterday.
It is, and that's later than our species evolved. So Homo sapiens evolved about 300,000 years ago. We overlapped in time with Homo erectus and actually with several other early human species.
Now, have you been able to track any kind of interaction between those species toward the end of the Homo erectus and the beginning of us?
We haven't been able to track interaction between Homo erectus and Homo sapiens, but based on genetics, we absolutely know that modern humans, Homo sapiens, and Neanderthals interbred when they came in contact with each other in Europe and Western Asia.
And that's why some of us still act like Neanderthals, right? There you go.
Maybe. That's at least why some of us still have Neanderthal DNA in us. That's right.
Now, what about DNA, and what difference has the ability to decode genes made in your field of endeavor?
So it hasn't made as much of a difference in my field as far as the evolution of human diet, although there's been some really interesting work done on looking at the edges of stone tools to see if you can find blood residues on them, so looking for blood proteins, and so that can give us an indication of exactly what kind of animals are being butchered. But really where DNA has become most important is understanding relationships between different early human species. So modern humans interbred not only with Neanderthals, but also with a population called Denisovans, which were found in Russia and China, and also overlapped in time and space with modern humans.
Wow. And you can actually track that through the DNA then. So when people go to have their DNA decoded, they can find some pretty interesting information going way back when.
Exactly. So that you can find out what kind of Neanderthal or Denisovan genes you have. And we're starting to understand what the function of some of those genes were. So some Neanderthal genes that entered the modern human genome had functions related to the immune system, and so other things that probably would have actually been advantageous.
Wow. Okay, folks, this is the 1219th edition of the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What, with Dr. Brianna Pobiner, who is a research paleoanthropologist with the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C. Today, we're tracking down what on earth did we eat way back when that made us so smart today, gave us the big, huge brains that we have that take so much of the, and 20% of our energy? Is that what you said?
That's correct. And that's just sort of at rest. That's not when we're thinking real hard either.
Okay, so we're going to think some more when we come back from this quick break. Want to ask Dr. what on earth she learned about about the present and the future from being a paleoanthropologist. Right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, Dr. Pobiner, you've taken on a very interesting mystery in tracking down the impact of eating meat on the human species as we evolve from many different species, I guess, into one dominant species. What do you think it was that we really ate? Was it just meat? Was it fat? Was it marrow? Was it all three of them?
I think it was everything. And so sometimes people, you know, will ask me if I follow a paleo diet, and I jokingly say, sure, I eat anything I can get my hands on.
Yeah.
So it's likely that, you know, throughout human prehistory that our diets were flexible, they were based on local resources, and that may have really changed seasonally when fruit was abundant or when animals were migrating. So probably a little bit of everything.
And there you go. But maybe having that impact of figuring out how to use a rock to break open those bones and get access to that rich bone marrow had a lot to do with it as well.
Yeah, I think it was probably important. And so particularly, it's, you know, in African savanna ecosystems, there's actually not a lot of fat that you can find readily available to eat. So marrow was probably really important as a good food resource for getting fat.
And, you know, when you read stories about the frontiersmen on the in the American West, one of the things they always talk about was the joy of roasting a buffalo hump over the campfire and roasting the marrow bones especially and getting the rich marrow out of those bones, because that was a source of fat in a very dry place.
Exactly, and it really would have been satisfying both from a taste perspective but also just a nutritional perspective.
Which is what I think every morning when I have my bone tea, by the way. So there you go. Now, of so many of 20 humanid species, there's just us. What happened?
Yeah, well, that is probably the biggest mystery of all. So all these other species, some which have been around, which were around for much longer than us, they're all extinct. But asking the question about why those other species went extinct, we have species that are going extinct today, and we're not entirely sure why. So it's much harder to figure out causes of extinction in the past than it is really to even sometimes figure out why species are going extinct today. Some of the major factors could have been competition, predation. When population levels get low, species or populations are more susceptible to extinction. Changes in climate and your preferred food resources go away. It probably wasn't just one factor for any of those species. It was probably multiple factors.
Mm-hmm. And who knows, maybe coronavirus happened or something like that too.
Well, exactly. Infectious diseases were probably a much bigger problem. Well, they're still a big problem today. But those oftentimes don't leave an imprint in our bones, so we wouldn't have been able to even tell that kind of thing from the fossil record.
What can't you tell from looking at bones?
A lot of things, unfortunately. So, you know, one thing, you can't necessarily tell how an individual died, whether that's an animal or an early human.
Unless there's some kind of significant mark, like a hole in the skull or something.
Exactly, or, you know, a stab wound to the chest or something like that. So most of the time, we actually do not know how early humans died. So that hampers our ability to figure out what causes of species extinctions might have been. From a diet perspective, we can't even really tell what proportion of the diet different kinds of foods made up. So I would love to know, you know, was meat 60% of Homo erectus's diet? Was it 10%? Did it depend on the season? Those things are still nearly impossible to tell from the archaeological record. In part, that's because some things preserve better than other things. So the things that don't preserve as well, like ancient plants or insects, we don't really have a good sense of how often they were consumed.
Isn't the biggest part of your job taking a little bit of information and extrapolating it into possibilities?
Well, at least it's taking some information, constructing a hypothesis, and figuring out how to test that hypothesis. So, you know, whether it's looking at one prehistoric site and trying to figure out, okay, here's a behavioral pattern I see. Let me look at the evidence from another site. Does that pattern hold up? That kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And what difference does it make that we look back as far as we have looked back? What difference does that make to today and to the future?
I mean, I think there are some lessons that we can draw from understanding our past dietary history and behavior. One of the hypotheses of why modern humans ended up surviving and Neanderthals didn't. I mean, first of all, Neanderthals were really excellent and competent hunters, but they seem to have been pretty specialized on large animal prey. They also ate plants, but they hunted large animals a lot. Modern humans in the same areas at the same time had a more diverse diet. They were eating small animals, tortoises, rabbits. They were probably eating more plants. And so maybe one lesson from that is that we should have a pretty diverse diet in order to make sure that the sources of our food don't end up going extinct.
Well, there you go. You have to husband your environment. Otherwise, it can backfire pretty quickly on you. And you look at these environments in which you search, and there's been so much change. Much of what you find buried, right? Way down deep in sediments.
Exactly. That's exactly what we're looking for, those things in situ, still in sediments.
How deep are those sediments buried?
It really varies. And so sometimes you can have sediment layers that are a couple centimeters thick. Sometimes they can be dozens of meters thick. So it really depends on what was laying down those sediments. Were they being laid down by water or wind or something? And other erosion that's happened since then. So it's very varied.
And what other necks of our world, neck of the woods, do you find interesting material dating back that far? Or is Africa the only place?
Well, really, before about 2 million years ago, it's just Africa. After that time, we start to get a little bit of a prehistoric record in Europe as well as Asia, particularly Indonesia. And so it does seem like when Homo erectus migrated out of Africa, potentially into Europe, but also although we don't have any Homo erectus fossils in Europe, we do have them in Indonesia and later on in China by about 1.8 million years ago. So they seem to have kind of been moving at a pretty good clip to get all the way over to Indonesia.
Getting out and about, probably on sailboats. What about the transition then from Homo erectus to Homo sapien?
So there were a couple species in between. So as far as we can tell, Homo erectus in Africa evolved into another species called Homo heidelbergensis. That's named after the town of Heidelberg in Germany, where the first fossils of that species were found. Homo heidelbergensis in Africa then evolved into Homo sapiens, but that species, Homo heidelbergensis, also migrated to Europe. In Europe, those populations evolved into Neanderthals. So really, Homo heidelbergensis is our direct ancestor.
Oh. And what made that transition? What evolved? What was the evolutionary process? What was the magic ticket that made us turn this from one thing into another?
That's a good question. So it's hard to observe evolution in a long-lived species like humans. We can certainly observe evolution in action in species like bacteria and other things that have very short generation times. So it's hard to speculate on exactly what caused one species to evolve into another. A lot of times that happens in the modern world when you have geographic isolation of a population. So a population ends up somewhere, they're not interbreeding with populations in other places, and they accumulate enough mutations that they end up being a different species. So geographic isolation is a big one. And sometimes it's also just genetic drift, where when you have smaller populations, you can have sort of an accumulation of even neutral mutations, not because of natural selection, but those populations become different enough that they're a different species and they can eventually no longer interbreed either with their parent species or their cousin species.
Well, Dr. Brianna Pobiner, your specialty is early man and they're meat-eating, right? So you're looking way, way, way back in time at how we really developed our meat-eating habits. Looking to today, what do you think of our current way of going about eating? I'm thinking most especially of the Impossible Burger.
Well, I will say I have tasted Impossible Burgers and they're pretty tasty.
Okay.
No, they're not necessarily a perfect replacement for meat if that's what you're in the mood for. But I will say, I am the last person. I will not pass judgment on, anybody's dietary choices or make any comments on sort of the ethics and values that go into modern food production. But I will say again that, having diversified sources of food seem to have served early humans and our species well in the past. And really the way that modern food production happens today is very unlike even a few hundred years ago and going further back from that.
Good. And finally, we have a few minutes left, but I'd like for you to tell us a little bit about the Smithsonian Institution and what you folks do there.
Sure. So I work at the National Museum of Natural History, which is one of the 19 museums or research institutions that make up the Smithsonian. And so we often joke that one of the best kept secrets, although we're trying not to keep it a secret, is that you may come to the Smithsonian Museums to see exhibits, but upstairs and behind all the walls are researchers, scientists, and other folks who are, engaged in making discoveries all the time. So it's a really fantastic place to work. I have wonderful colleagues, and I really enjoy the intellectual freedom that I have here to pursue the research questions that really interest me.
Is it like a university?
It's a little bit, it's not quite like a university in the sense that we are not a degree-granting institution. I actually have an appointment. I'm an associate research professor at George Washington University, which is about 10 blocks away. So I teach classes there and I can advise students there. But it is like a university in the sense that there are researchers who are hired to basically carry out their research. At universities, they're also teaching. Here at the Smithsonian, oftentimes we're also developing exhibits and doing outreach programs, but also spend a good proportion of our time doing research.
Is the Smithsonian related to the federal government in any way?
So we're a quasi-federal institution. Some of our funding comes from the federal government. Some of our funding comes from things like grants or private donations. And so we're basically quasi-federal. So there are a lot of our staff are federal employees, but a lot of our staff are not.
And what about all of those young folks out there in the world who are looking for an interesting thing to pursue as a career? What would you tell them about paleo anthropology?
So I would tell them that the reason that I'm a paleoanthropologist is because it's a lot of fun. So I get to...
Well, you know what it looks like you're having fun to me.
I am having fun. I get to, ask really interesting research questions, I also like paleoanthropology. It is inherently interdisciplinary. So most of the time as a paleoanthropologist, you work in teams with other people who are either asking the same question using a different method or asking a similar question, or, you know, you're working with a team at a prehistoric site. I'm a people person. I really enjoy working with other people. I also get a chance to do a lot of education and outreach in my role at the Natural History Museum. So being an anthropologist, a paleoanthropologist, is a lot of fun.
Tell us about your team at one of the digs and what other people are doing there with you.
Sure. So let's take Alorga Siley, for example. So this is a research site that has been under investigation under the leadership of Dr. Rick Potts, who's the head of the Human Origins Program. Normally, when we're out excavating, there will be anywhere from maybe two or three to up to like 10 researchers from all over the world. They're specialists in either geology or paleontology or archaeology or, you know, some other ology that is, or paleoanthropology that's related to the questions that we ask at Alorga Siley. But we also have a wonderful skilled team of Kenyan excavators that we hire to come with us every year to the excavations. We also have cooks and mechanics and drivers and basically a whole wonderful team of people that just make the field work run really smoothly.
I was right. You're having too much fun.
I can't disagree with you.
And good. So what do you think about the future then? Where are we going to take this pursuit of knowledge of the way back past?
So I'm really optimistic about scientific discoveries in the future, mostly because I see so many of my research colleagues either inventing new methods to ask the questions that we've been asking all along, or going to sites that haven't been explored before, or going back to sites that have been explored to do new excavations or new surveys. And so I just think like there's a whole world of discoveries out there waiting to be made.
Well, good. And for all of you who are interested in more, I suggest you just do a search on Brianna Pobner, P-O-B-I-N-E-R, and you'll find some very interesting Smithsonian videos about her work that are just a lot of fun. And then when you see them, you'll think, yep, she's having too much fun. This has been the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour, with Dr. Brianna Pobner, research paleoanthropologist, Smithsonian Institution. I want to thank you all for joining us today. And remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain: cheap food isn't. And it most certainly wasn't cheap a million years ago. Thank you, Dr. Brianna.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.